Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to Young Israel of Southfield, both those here in person, as well as our participants who are watching from right here in Southfield, as well as participants that we actually have throughout the country this evening. I would like to now introduce Sarah Moore, who's a member of Young Israel of Southfield. And in addition, she is herself a lawyer. And she and several other of our members who are part of our education committee have put this evening and this program together. And we are most grateful to Sarah and to as well as our moderators and our participants this evening. Without further ado, Mrs. Sarah Moore.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming. I'm thrilled to present this evening's discussion. We have an excellent group of panelists and moderators lined up for you, really experts in their respective fields, and I'm certain this evening will prove very thought-provoking and interesting. Before I begin, I did want to state very clearly that this program is meant to be purely factual and educational, not controversial or political in any way, but really to give all of us a deeper understanding of how Torah and Halacha think about the topic of termination of pregnancy. As most of you know, various states have recently passed laws, very restrictive laws with respect to abortion, with virtually no exceptions. The Supreme Court is in the midst of deciding whether or not to uphold these laws or to overturn years of precedent in this area. And I found myself wondering, what is the Jewish perspective on all of this? Would Torah and Halacha agree or disagree? And my hope at the end of this evening is we can all walk away with a deeper understanding of the Jewish perspective on this topic. There will be some time for questions at the end, so feel free to write them in the chat. Before I hand this over to our moderators, I did want to briefly introduce our excellent moderators for you. We'll be having Brittany Goldberg, who will be moderating the legal component of this evening. She is an associate at Bush Seifert in Troy. Before joining Bush Seifert, she clerked for former federal judge Avron Cohen, no relation to her, in the Eastern District of Michigan. Brittany specializes in defense litigation for multi-district litigation, complex commercial litigation, and appeals. That is a mouthful. We'll also have Dr. Stephen Lefkowitz, who will be moderating the medical component of this evening. Dr. Lefkowitz is a board-certified OBGYN physician whose interests include minimally invasive surgical procedures and care, general and high-risk obstetrics, and contraception management. He currently works for Somerset Gynecology and Obstetrics and is a member of the William Beaumont Hospital Department of Gynecology Patient Care and Committee. Thank you so much, and I'll hand this over to Brittany and Dylan. Thank you so much. Okay. So we're going to start off with a softball question. Tell us a bit about your background in the legal field.
Currently I'm a professor at Wayne State Law School. For my own law school, I attended University of Chicago. After that, I clerked for a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. Subsequent to that, I worked in private practice for a law firm based in Boston, and I also worked on financial policy for a think tank affiliated with Harvard Law School while in Boston.
Can you give us some background on how the Supreme Court has treated restrictions on abortion prior to hearing the Texas case?
Okay, so in order to understand the field in the Supreme Court's abortion precedent, it's important to sort of get back to basics. The 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which was adopted in 1868 in the aftermath of the Civil War, it says that states cannot deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The Supreme Court has ruled that this language doesn't just govern the procedures that states must follow. Right? You might think that the amendment refers to you can't do X without due process of law. You might think that only governs the procedures that states must follow before it deprives a person of life, liberty, or property. But the Supreme Court has ruled that that's not the case. It actually protects certain substantive rights. Right? The states cannot infringe on certain substantive rights without a very good reason. One of the substantive rights the Supreme Court has said is the right to privacy. In 1973, the famous Roe v. Wade case, the court held that the right to privacy protected by the 14th Amendment includes the right to have an abortion. In Roe, the Supreme Court adopted a trimester framework. So in the first trimester, according to Roe, states can basically not interfere with the decision to have an abortion at all. And after the first trimester, until viability, that was the line that the court adopted then. When that is, that's an important question, and I defer to the medical experts on that. And also, it's a bit of a shifting target, because when it was in 1973 is different from when viability is now, due to medical advances. But so the second part is, you know, prior to, in the first trimester, no restrictions on abortion, according to Roe. In after that, until viability, there can be some restrictions, but only to the extent they're related to, or some regulations, but only the extent they're related to preserving maternal health. And then after viability, the state can restrict abortion, can ban abortion outright, except when the procedure is necessary to protect the life or the health of the patient. Fast forward 19 years, in another case called Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the other notable, or most notable case in this area, it confirmed the basic holding of Roe v. Wade that the 14th Amendment protects the right to abortion with an important difference. It replaced the categorical rule for the first trimester. Roe had said no interference with the right to abortion in the first trimester. And Casey says, actually, the important line is viability, and at any time before viability, the state can restrict abortion as long as the restriction doesn't impose an undue burden on the right to abortion. And that's the important, you know, viability is the important line, and the test is whether it imposes an undue burden on the right to abortion. And that's where basically things stand. Okay.
So, moving to Texas specifically, what does the Texas law do, and how is it different from previous attempts to restrict abortion early in pregnancy?
Okay, so the Texas law, you may have heard of it as SB 8, Senate Bill 8, so it prohibits doctors from performing abortions if they can detect a fetal heartbeat sometime around the 6th week. So you can't perform an abortion after the 6th week. And so far, that's pretty standard for state abortion restrictions. Many states have at least laws on the books that say doctors cannot perform an abortion after, detecting a fetal heartbeat. A fetal heartbeat can be detected, so around 6 weeks. So that's not different, the substance of the law. But it has a unique enforcement mechanism. The idea is that the law cannot be enforced by any state officials, police, state prosecutors, anyone like that. SBA, the Texas law, relies on private individuals to bring lawsuits against doctors or anyone who provides or aids or abets an abortion. And anyone who brings a lawsuit can recover $10,000, at least $10,000, from the person who violated the law. So rather than have state officials enforce the law, enforce this restriction on abortion, it's up to private individuals to bring lawsuits. So how is this different from, why would this make a difference? Maybe contrary to popular imagination, the Supreme Court, federal courts, including the Supreme Court, don't actually invalidate laws in the abstract. They don't act against laws in the abstract. Rather, courts, including the Supreme Court, provide relief from particular identifiable people to other people, to the people who bring suit. So, for example, the Supreme Court has ruled about 100 years ago that someone can sue the state's top law enforcement official. Right. If you think there's a law, a criminal law or a civil restriction that violates your constitutional rights, you can sue the state's top enforcement official, usually the attorney general, to prevent them from enforcing that unconstitutional law against you. But you have someone who's identifiable, the state's top enforcement official, who you can bring suit against. But in this case, there's no identifiable law enforcer, right? No one's come out of the woodwork to say, I'm going to bring suit. So there's no one, the idea at least behind the design of this enforcement mechanism is that there's no one for someone who wants to challenge the constitution of this law proactively, before they perform an abortion, to sue for relief. They have no one, they can't go to court and say, you can't enforce the law against me because there's no one there. So state officials can't enforce the law. The only way to protect what at least precedent says is the right to perform an abortion or the right to obtain an abortion is once someone sues you, once a private individual has already sued you, you raise the defense that the law is unconstitutional, but then you're already potentially on the hook for $10,000 or more in damages. So the idea is it's very difficult to proactively protect the constitutional right. You can only do it defensively once you're already sued. That's the idea of this novel enforcement mechanism. The court, as Sarah mentioned, has heard two cases arguing that the law can actually be challenged proactively. One brought by abortion providers in Texas and another brought by the United States, the federal government. The cases haven't been decided yet and the courts haven't stayed the Texas law, so it is actually currently in effect.
And so I know there's the Texas law that we talked about, and then there's also a Mississippi law that's coming to the Supreme Court. So can you explain what's the difference between the two of those?
Okay, the Mississippi law is different in two ways. One, substantively, what the law says you can or cannot do, it bans abortion after 15 weeks, not 6 weeks or around 6 weeks, like the Texas law. Like the Texas law, it also has some narrow restrictions for medical emergencies, but not other or narrow exceptions like medical emergencies. But it doesn't have other exceptions that are often found in some of these state restrictions, like exception in the case of rape or incest. And also the second important difference is it doesn't have a complex enforcement mechanism like the Texas law. It's sort of a traditional restriction enforced by state officials. So it doesn't have that runaround. It's just a straight up restriction enforced by Mississippi state law enforcement officials.
So here's a two-part question. What implications are there for abortion laws in other states because of this Texas law? And then what is the current state of abortion law in Michigan specifically?
So I'll just mention before responding to this question, because it's an important segue. So the Mississippi law is, unlike the Texas law, is not in effect. Because in the Texas law, the Supreme Court has said, we actually don't know whether anyone can bring suit to stop enforcement of this law. So we're not going to stay it. It's currently in effect. Mississippi law clearly is unconstitutional under the Supreme Court's current precedent. And so the Court of Appeals said, there's no question it's not allowed under Casey. And so the law is not in effect. Mississippi has asked the Supreme Court to overrule its precedent, to overrule Roe and Casey and say that actually the 14th Amendment does not protect the right to abortion. It has also argued, right, so it's also said to the Supreme Court, even if you aren't willing to overturn Roe and Casey outright and you still recognize there's some constitutionally protected right to abortion, we think that it shouldn't depend on viability. So that's the other route that the defenders of the Mississippi law have said, well, maybe, viability, which currently understood, I think by lawyers at least, to be somewhere between 22 and 24 weeks, that shouldn't be the line. It should be earlier. And then that would also allow a 15-week ban. So if the court overturns Roe, like Mississippi is asking it to do, 21 states currently have laws on the books that would ban abortion in some form, whether it's 15 weeks, 6 weeks, or something else. Several of those states, including Michigan, those aren't new bans on or restrictions on abortion. Those are pre-Roe bans that were never taken off the books. They just haven't been enforced because it's unconstitutional to enforce them under current Supreme Court law. So under the Michigan Penal Code, anyone who performs an abortion, except in a case of a medical emergency, has committed a felony. And that's the law on the books. And so if, depending on what the Supreme Court rules in the Mississippi case, but if the Supreme Court were to overrule Roe and Casey outright and say there is no constitutionally protected right to abortion, then that law would be constitutional again, and it could be constitutionally enforced. The current Attorney General of Michigan has said that she won't enforce it as a matter of her discretion, or she can choose which cases to bring and which cases not to bring. A number of state prosecutors have said they won't enforce it, but that's just a question of which cases they decide to bring. And, you know, if this court overturns Roe, that's a question of which cases to bring and which cases not to bring. It's not a question of what's constitutional. So that can change with the next Attorney General, who has different priorities.
One more question. Okay. If the Supreme Court rules that more restrictive abortion laws are allowed under the Constitution, might those laws be challenged on the basis, on a different basis, like they restrict the exercise of religion?
So that's an interesting angle. Right. So let's say, you know, there's no, I guess the question is, you know, there's no right to abortion under the 14th Amendment. But let's say hypothetically, there's a case that abortion isn't allowed under some state law, but is not only allowed under Jewish law, but required. It's understood to be required. And, you know, this, I guess, is a preview of the halachic portion of tonight's program. But assuming that there is such a case, you know, could someone challenge the law, the restriction, as an unconstitutional burden on the exercise of religion if something is required under religious law but not allowed under state law? Generally, that wouldn't be under current First Amendment, you know, free exercise law. That would that's unlikely to be successful. And the reason is in a 1990 case called Employment Division versus Smith, the Supreme Court said that the basic test for whether a law unconstitutionally restricts the exercise of religion, I'll rephrase that. I said that a law that's neutral as between religious activities and comparable secular activities, right? Even if there's a religious act, as long as it has no discriminatory purpose, so the law wasn't passed, you know, to target religion, and that depends on the motive of the legislators who passed it, and is neutral as between, you know, religious activities and comparable secular activities, then even if it burdens the right to or one's exercise of religion, it doesn't violate the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. So in this case, you know, I would think the most abortion restrictions aren't targeted at specific religions, so don't have discriminatory purpose. They are neutral, right? It doesn't depend on why someone wants to obtain the abortion, whether they want it for some secular purpose or they think it's religiously permitted or even required. So the First Amendment case is under the current precedent is unlikely to succeed. But that's, you know, just two words.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey, good evening. I'd like to introduce Dr. Caroline Buter, who originally hails from New York, where she did her medical school and training at Mount Sinai and eventually made her way over to Michigan for her fellowship in high-risk obstetrics. She was on staff and head of the obstetrical division at DMC in Wayne, and the past 2.5 years actually made her way over to Beaumont Health and is currently one of the high-risk specialists at Beaumont Health, who I get to work with on a routine basis. So I'm going to give you a few questions as well. Some of them will be kind of softball ones, but I think one of the important things about medical perspective and about termination is kind of some basic definitions. And what is, you know, termination abortion and, you know, and kind of what are the different types of abortions that are performed?
So abortion is a word that's actually derived from the Latin, from a word that means miscarriage. And so in its most basic sense, an abortion is just a synonym for miscarriage of a pregnancy. In medicine, we differentiate between spontaneous abortions, which I think we usually refer to as either miscarriages or pregnancy losses, versus induced abortions, which we also refer to as termination of pregnancy medically. To effect a termination of pregnancy, to end a pregnancy and remove the products of conception or the fetus and placenta, it can be done either medically, and that's by using medications. And different medications are used at different gestational ages. So people have probably heard of RU486 or mifepristone. That can be used early in pregnancy, in the first couple of weeks of pregnancy. And that's actually become a very important mode of pregnancy termination in the United States. In addition, there can be surgical terminations, and those are done through procedures that in varying ways make the opening to the womb or the cervix open, and then the products of conception are removed or medication is given to induce the body to remove those products.
So we talked about in the last panel a lot about viability and heartbeat, and so just for, you know, from the audience, from a medical perspective, when does the heartbeat form, and you know, when do we as medical professionals typically consider viability, what gestational age is?
Also pretty complicated questions. What we say when the heartbeat forms is when we're able to detect it using our form of technology. And our form of technology at this point is ultrasound. And we're able to see different things depending on if ultrasound is done vaginally or if it's done abdominally. It varies a little bit from person to person, but in general, with current technology, we're talking about 6 weeks for when fetal cardiac activity or a heartbeat can be seen. In terms of viability, meaning ability to live on your own, that has indeed been a moving target. When I was a resident, that was much closer to the 28-week mark. That's how long ago that was. Now it is generally considered to be in the 23 to 24 week range, though there have been some surviving pregnancies that have delivered at about 22 weeks of gestation. And so that line is also moving, but despite changes, it hasn't really moved back beyond that 22 week line, because there's a very big difference between prematurity and immaturity. Immaturity being that the body is not capable of even responding to the current technology. How that will change in the future is unclear, but right now we still keep it in that 22 to 24 week range.
And in terms of the, we're talking a little bit more about gestational ages, you know, and the timing of which abortions commonly occur, what typical gestations are abortions commonly performed at for, you know, women in the United States?
Okay. So I want to take a step back because I didn't clarify. When we talk about 6 weeks of pregnancy, 6 weeks of pregnancy occurs 4 weeks after conception. So most of the time we talk about menstrual age, age from the last menstrual period, versus conceptional age. So often somebody will say, but I just got pregnant 4 weeks ago. How am I 6 weeks pregnant? It's because those first 2 weeks before ovulation even occurs is part of what we consider gestational age in common operating obstetric terms. So most terminations in the United States occur in the first trimester. And that accounts for about 90% in total. Most of those, about two-thirds of all terminations, happen before 8 weeks of gestation. Getting to that 6 weeks of gestation that we're talking about for this law means identifying the day you missed a period, which means knowing exactly when you expect your period to come, identifying that day, having or getting a home pregnancy test or a medical test very quickly, and then arranging to have that procedure done within days of finding out this information. And so part of where that restriction is particularly cumbersome is not everybody is able to either find out the information, make the decision, and arrange the logistics of having that procedure done in what ends up being essentially a week of time. And so it's particularly difficult and particularly cumbersome to do. Very few procedures in the United States, about 5%, are done after 16 weeks of gestation. And many of those are some of the more unusual, either medically indicated indications or more complex social indications.
In terms of other just some basic demographics for termination, can you talk a little bit about some abortion trends and the typical demographics of patients that we see coming in requesting terminations of pregnancy?
Well, I think one of the reasons why this ends up being difficult is that often we don't see people having terminations as being like us. And I think this is where frequently people don't think about it or don't get as concerned. But approximately 40% of women who have terminations are white, about 30% are Black, about 25% are Latina. Most of those are going to be in their 20s. About 12% are going to be adolescents or young women in their teens that are choosing to have these procedures. The who also involves the why, and the why involves social indications. So I think some of what's already been said is that social can range from the wrong person, the wrong time, contraceptive failure, to more complicated things like rape and incest, which also fall under that social category. The why can include risk of health to the mother, and that can be relatively broadly defined. So we will sometimes see women who are imminently going to die if that pregnancy is not terminated. But more often, it's knowing that somebody has a significant risk. So for instance, there are certain types of maternal heart disease where the risk of maternal death is about 50% or greater, where we will actually recommend pregnancy termination specifically because we know the risk to maternal life is so high. As I'm sure you've seen, there are women who will come in hemorrhaging. That first trimester and second trimester bleeding that are so common. But if you are losing blood faster than it can be poured into you at a gestational age where the baby can't survive outside, then the answer is to empty the uterus, which unfortunately is a termination. And this is often occurring in desired, planned, wanted pregnancies. And then the last category of the why is because of fetal indications. And that ranges from genetic problems, chromosomal problems, physical birth defects, as well as things that put the pregnancy at risk of bad outcomes following. And these go from almost or lethal birth defects to ones that may be associated with a brief and difficult lifespan, or genetic problems, things like Tay-Sachs disease, where people will choose that this is not what they want to continue for their child.
Points. And I think, you know, it's important for a lot of other people to kind of understand about the safety surrounding abortion as well. And prior to the legalization of abortion in the United States, what was seen historically in hospitals for women who were attempting abortion, you know, without medical, medical intervention?
So
I did my residency in New York, and I was a resident where a significant portion of my time was at a city hospital. And I did my residency from 88 to 92. And the attendings that I worked with primarily were people who had been active in gynecology and obstetrics in the pre-abortion era. And when we looked at the floor on our city hospital, two-thirds of the floor was gynecology, a third of the floor was for obstetrics. Huge service, okay? And when we asked why the rooms were so weird, is because two-thirds of the gynecology beds were used for abortion complications. Young women who still were willing to go risk their lives to terminate their pregnancy, who ended up septic in ICUs with hysterectomies, never having the option. And so for many physicians, knowing that pregnancy termination has been something that has been going on for all recorded history, felt that making sure that it was legal and safe was the most important thing that they could do for women, to enable those women to continue their lives, because making abortion illegal doesn't stop it. It limits it, and it forces women to take desperate measures. And this has been seen in countries around the world where abortion is illegal at any gestational age, where women will buy medication on the internet, will poison themselves, will take medications that aren't proven. And then the medical system takes care of them when those problems happen. In the United States, when done safely and appropriately, the risk of having a pregnancy termination at any gestational age by any method is safer for the mother than a full-term pregnancy, statistically. So again, if the plan is to have a baby, clearly having a full-term pregnancy is the way to go. But the argument that a full-term pregnancy is safer to the mom is and has always been incorrect, again, with safe, legal, medically sanctioned sort of methodologies. And then the rumors of it causes cancer or it's associated with cancer have never been proven. And they're just one more thing that's meant to intimidate women from getting procedures.
Can you tell me a little bit how you would approach a patient who is considering a termination, or counsel them on, you know, their options for termination, I guess, from a medical perspective?
So for me, this is a conversation that frequently comes up, but it frequently comes up in the context of either my role taking care of a mom with significant health problems. And frankly, you know, my preference for those is, as you know, please come see me before you get pregnant so we can have this discussion. And I can say, just please don't do this. It's not a good idea. Or in the finding of significant abnormalities, usually on ultrasound, though sometimes through other methods. For in a medical context, when we're talking about situations such as these, as well as sometimes in other situations, the medical basis is we usually do not recommend pregnancy termination unless we anticipate that we're going to lose the mom. That still remains obviously her choice. We don't force anybody to do anything. We don't pressure women to do, but we can make recommendations. And there's a big difference between recommending and offering or educating. So if I'm taking care of a woman who I think is likely to die or deteriorate in a very brief period of time, that we are not going to be able to temporize, get them to a point where their pregnancy might have a chance of surviving, then the recommendation is, we know this is hard, but we want you to survive. Because otherwise, without a living mom, there is not going to be a living pregnancy. And I think this is something that Rabbi Morris is going to touch on more, so that we'll see if you don't have a mother that survives, you don't have a baby. And this happens at 10 weeks, 12 weeks, etc. And for those who have options, what we try to do is provide a framework and provide information. The issue of how individuals approach birth defects, genetic abnormalities, the potential for long-term care, complicated care for their children is so individual and it's so personally value-based that we don't specifically counsel one way or the other in that sense. Meaning, I tell patients it's my job to give you information, to provide you tools, but it is not my job to make a decision for you. It is not my job to judge you. It is not my job to do anything other than support you in this process. And that is the framework that we use under those circumstances.
And now, sum up with a few kind of myths about abortion. I don't know if you have an opportunity to kind of debunk a few abortion myths that people hear or read on the internet of either, you know, late trimester abortions or other things of kind of what, from a medical perspective, that means.
So I think, you know, the thing that people heard about most in Michigan is this word partial birth abortion, which I will tell you that nobody I know as a gynecologic provider had any idea what that procedure was. We had no idea what was illegal, which made it fascinating for the people who do terminations to be able to follow the law, because nobody knows what that means. In theory, I understood this to be a procedure where the uterus is open, the fetus is removed, but it still has a continuing heartbeat. That is generally not the way the procedure is done. And so hence it was extraordinarily complicated, but it also led to a procedure that is commonly done at later gestational ages where medication is injected to the fetus or into the umbilical cord to stop the heartbeat before any further procedures are performed. Which in some ways the patients and families often find is sort of kinder, because then the procedure is functionally already done. And then it's just a matter of everything coming out. But that's one of the ways that medicines ended up having to change in response to nebulous, difficult to understand laws that are written by non-physicians.
And then can you speak about some of the waiting periods that practically patients have to undergo when they're looking to have a termination?
Different states have different regulations regarding waiting periods and the information that has to be provided. So Michigan, for instance, has a 24-hour waiting period. So a consent has to be signed. Now, currently, the nice thing is that consent form is actually available online and can be read and signed electronically. And I think it goes under the presumption that women wake up in the morning and they're like, dang, there is nothing I want to do more than have a pregnancy termination, and that there's no thought given to this process before. But it's meant as a barrier. And there are many barriers in women's healthcare that are set. We have waiting periods for Medicaid patients for tubal ligation, for sterilization procedures that don't exist for other women, for women with private insurance, for instance, meaning that you are unable to make this without having a month's time to wait. The other thing that Michigan does is you are required to offer the patient information about the pregnancy, about pregnancy options, including adoption and parenting. Also, the sort of nicer loophole is that while you're required to offer it, the patient can then throw it right in the garbage as soon as they're done. So they are currently not required to read it or look at it. And there are states where they are required to sit in the room and watch a video. So Michigan says you are required to give the patient the information. There is no requirement that the patient say, yes, I read it, I understand it, I get it. So for the practicality is I will often refer patients to a website, document it, and it's a state website, and it's not written that badly. Let them review, tell them you review it, you don't review it. Often this comes up where it's insulting to families, because what they'd like is to be able to have a baby at the right time, under the right circumstances, with all of the right things happening in their lives. And so being told that they have options is not particularly what they want to hear. And thank you all for being here, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Rabbi. I think, have you joined us up on the panel? So I had decided to continue up with some further questions for Rabbi Morris. For anyone who's not a congregant member, Rabbi Morris has been the rabbi of our shul here at Young Israel Southfield since, or at least 20 years now, and you know, has graciously agreed to have a continue the conversation from a halachic perspective and a Jewish perspective on termination. And so, you know, I think the questions are certainly complex, and I think the point of the panel is not to have you address every specific scenario, you know, that could possibly happen in those situations. We always refer patients to meet with their doctor and the rabbi on any individual basis. But just a few basic questions on how does the halacha intersect with some of the topics we discussed this evening, especially when there's, you know, situations, and I'm going to focus first on, you know, maternal risk, and how does the halacha interpret that, and, you know, what does the halacha say we are allowed or not allowed to do?
Thank you so much, Stephen. So I want to thank all the panelists and moderators this evening, and Sara for putting this all together. Let me begin by just pointing out something we don't think about in terms of Jewish law, but that it always needs to be paramount in any issue that we discuss, and that is the sensitivity issue, the Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, that these issues, as Dr. Pruder just mentioned, are very sensitive, very personal. And whenever we address an issue like this, and certainly when a couple may come to a rabbi to talk about it, so there's the objective halachic analysis in terms of what can be done, should be done. But there's also, you're dealing with neshamas, you're dealing with human beings who are facing a very difficult decision, and it can be very emotionally painful. And we have to understand that, about loving our neighbor, that has to take precedence in terms of how we talk and address, and to be careful not to judge and to in any way be condescending or to condemn someone when they're facing this this challenge or this dilemma. So that's number one. Number two, when it comes to abortion and the halachic approach and how we view, what exactly halacha says about abortion, there's two questions. Question number one is, what is it? Is it permissible? And question number two is it required? In other words, from two different angles. What is allowed, and maybe in some situations this is even halachically mandated. And you asked the question about the health of the mother, and we're going to get to that. That's going to be a critical issue in terms of guaranteeing that the mother who's alive, we want to keep her alive. I mean, we're going to keep her healthy from a Jewish perspective. Now, the question people always ask is, you know, where does the Torah, where does Judaism talk about abortion? So there's a fascinating Gemara that actually quotes a pasuk all the way at the beginning of the Torah from Parshas Noach, where the Torah says the following, Shafech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech, which can be interpreted many different ways, but the way the rabbis have this additional level of interpretation, that a person who kills a person in a person, Ha'adam ba'adam, a person in a person. What's a person inside a person? The Gemara understands that this is a fetus. This is an embryo, a fetus growing inside a mother. If you terminate that embryo, that fetus, damo yishafech, you've committed murder, and you are you can be killed for doing that. It's like if someone pulls a trigger and kills someone with a gun, they can be in theory killed by a Jewish beitin. Same thing with this act of terminating a pregnancy. And the way the Gemara understands this Gemara is the Gemara says that this is simply referring actually to a non-Jew. This is Ben Noach before the Torah was given. And the Torah says that this applies if a non-Jew kills performs an abortion, that's the other ruling. And so the different poskim over the ages talk about, well, what about if a Jew does this? And so there's a Tosfos who says, well, you have a principle. There can't be something that a non-Jew is prohibited from doing, the Jew is allowed to do. It doesn't exist. And therefore, the Tosfos understands that just like a non-Jew can't do this, so a Jew also is not allowed to do this. And there's also a whole discussion, well, would it be a capital offense or would it be considered to be murder? But it's not necessarily a capital offense. And there's lots of discussion what exactly that means. There may be other examples. Someone's about to die anyway. And they may not be, in theory, violating you may not be put to death because they sort of killed a dead person, but it's still considered to be murder. So on the one hand, you have that Gemara that seems to be the basis for the fact that abortion is not allowed. Now, specifically the case of a mother whose life is in danger. So there's another Gemara in Sanhedrin that quotes a Mishnah in Olos. This is probably like the source, Jewish source that discusses this issue. Where there the Gemara tells us that if you have a woman who's in childbirth, and actually the case that's presented in that the Mishnah is that she's about to deliver, but the fetus is still inside. And the mother's life is hemorrhaging, whatever, the mother is going to die. We're pretty confident the mother is not going to live in that case. So says the Mishnah the following, that, exact words, katan harodef nita latzilo benavsho, kesova harodef eno tzar chasra, loshna god loshna katan, says the Mishnah that if the baby is still inside the mother's womb, you're allowed to. The Gemara says you literally put your hands in and dismember the fetus to terminate the pregnancy to cause the mother to live. But once the head has left the womb, so at that point it's now the baby is now viable. At that point, you can't kill the baby. The baby is, heaven is causing this thing to happen to the mother, and it's tragic, but you couldn't. But what's fascinating from this Mishnah, from the way the Gemara understands it, is that if the mother's life is at risk, you're allowed to terminate the pregnancy. And now comes the biggest question. The biggest question is that only in the case where the mother's life is at risk? But if the mother's life is not at risk, then it's not allowed. And if it's not allowed, then one why? What's the problem here? Right, we saw this this idea of this Ben Noach, of this of a non-Jew, and then we say it applies to a Jew as well. What's the problem? Why is this not allowed? So there's two schools of thought here. And then I'll turn it back over to you, Stephen. One school of thought is that in fact it is Ritzicha, that it is murder. That there's a heartbeat, there's a fetus that's growing inside the mother's womb, and it's not completely living like once the baby emerges, but nonetheless, it is on some level a living creature. And by terminating that pregnancy, except for the case where the mother's life, her life comes first, she is fully living at this point. But if her life is not in danger, so then that's considered to be murder. That's the position of the Rambam. The Rambam is. Take the Rambam's opinion very seriously. And famously, Rav Moshe Feinstein, to a very significant degree, was a major rabbinic decisor here in America the last century. He felt the Rambam was absolutely correct. To the extent that Rav Moshe Feinstein only allowed a termination if it was for certain that the mother's life would be at risk. How you determine just for certain, Dr. Kruger talked about 50%. More than 50% that that the mother is not going to make it with some heart abnormalities, a little bit unclear. But if you're not so certain and it's maybe just a possibility, a small possibility, then he would not allow that termination. Others in the position of the Rambam will say, no, even if there's a small possibility, we don't play games with the mother's life, and they would allow the termination. The other school of thought is that it's not murder. We don't consider it to be abortion to be a murder. Rather, it's another biblical prohibition. That's a general prohibition of chavala. You're not allowed to cause injury to a person. You can't injure yourself for no good reason. However, if you have a good reason why to injure yourself, maybe you need to draw blood to test the blood. Maybe someone has some physical abnormality and they need to have an operation to correct it. There's a legitimate reason why to allow a to injure oneself to cause blood to leave one's body, then that would be that is you don't violate the chavala, and therefore most famously the Tzitz Eliezer also lived in the last century of Eliezer Waldenberg, who lived in Yerushalayim. He was of the opinion that it's chavala, and therefore he was much more lenient when it came to abortion. Besides situations where the mother's life is in danger, he also sometimes allowed for when there's a serious emotional stress. Challenges, concerns about the viability of the baby once it's born, in terms of what that would mean for the mother, for the parents, and it had a lot more flexibility. When it's financial concerns, can we make this work or not? So then the post came a little bit more, much more hesitant, a little. They're much, much more hesitant, and we try to figure out other ways to help this family out to make it work. But again, those are the two major schools of thought regarding the abortion issue.
So when we talk about, you mentioned quite a bit about maternal health and maternal well-being, I guess, is there any other logical allowances on the fetal side of things, on the fetal behalf? And what happens when we encounter situations where there's either a major or minor fetal abnormality? And how does the halacha, congregant or person approached you with a similar question, the mother's health was otherwise healthy, how would you counsel and discuss the halachic perspective of that?
Yes, that's a great question. And it's interesting, mostly halacha does not talk so much about fetal health, it's more about the mother's health. And again, whether she's going to physically, live through this experience, and number two, her emotional well-being. However, what's interesting is that, my own Rabbi of Herschel Schachter has talked a lot about this, is the question of, well, even that you take the Rambam's position that it's murder, well, maybe it's only murder if this baby is going to be viable. Because what happens in a situation where the child's going to be born, and certainly it's not going to, usually in halacha, it's like 30 days considered to be whether you're viable or not. Even though for certain this child's not going to make it past 30 days, even it's going to, the baby will make it past 30 days, but immediately it's going to have to be hooked up to machines and artificially we'd have to keep this child living. Well, maybe halacha doesn't view that as viable. And that maybe once someone is already born and living, and then there's questions, do we hook someone up to some sort of respirator to allow them to continue living? That's a separate question. But to get go, if we can tell from the beginning that in order for this child to be able to function or to have any semblance of life, to be able to breathe, they're going to have to be, use some sort of artificial technology to keep them going, then maybe even in that this most radical position of the Rambam or Moshe Feinstein would even allow a termination in such a case. Rav Waldenberg famously talked about the Tay-Sachs case, and that's where he was had the leniency that one can in fact engage if the parents feel that emotionally it's going to be just so difficult and so painful to raise a child in such a way to see a child suffer. That he was much more lenient with that. Again, Moshe would be a lot more stringent on the matter. And like most areas of Jewish law, it really comes down to everyone asking their own local, not only a local rabbi, but someone who's really competent in this area to really get an understanding of the best halachic approach in terms of how to proceed.
And then does the halacha differentiate? You mentioned about certain times of gestational age. How does the halacha differentiate certain what's considered viable from a halachic perspective?
Yeah, so that's also very interesting. So there's, again, my Rebbe of Herschel Schachter cites this sefer called the Torah's Chesed by the leader Rav. He lived in the turn of the 20th century. And he also was struggling with that opinion of the Rambam. At what point is it exactly, is it murder? Because the case that the Mishnah talks about is that the mother is about to deliver. and the mother's about to deliver. She's in the delivery room, and when things are going downhill, we need to save the mother's life. Well, at that point, the baby is viable, it's just that the mother's life is going to take precedence. But what happens in a much earlier stage, we talked earlier about 22 weeks, 23, 24 weeks, you know, if it's before that period, where the baby would not be viable if delivered at that stage, maybe again, according to the Rambam, that wouldn't be considered to be murder, because you're not terminating a viable, functioning, livable, someone who could live. And therefore, he was of the opinion that prior to that period, that one perhaps would not violate, if you assume it's murder, that it wouldn't be a murder. And Moshe Feinstein was extremely strict on this area, and he went as far as to say, even within the first 40 days, we're in Jewish, some are familiar that in Jewish law, there's even a little bit more flexibility within the first 40 days. The Gemara talks about this phrase of Mayada, Ba'alma, it's just considered to be liquid from a halachic perspective. Limbs haven't really formed yet. And in fact, it's interesting, the Gemara talks about if a woman has a pregnancy that begins, but it's terminated before 40 days, and then the next pregnancy, she has a successful pregnancy and delivers a boy, that boy may be considered to be the opening of her womb, and that would require a pidyon aben. If a woman had a miscarriage, God forbid, at the six months, seven months, and then had a boy, there wouldn't be a pidyon aben. So you see within that first 40 days, there's a lot more of flexibility. Moshe Feinstein felt from some other halachic sources, this very interesting halacha is, let's say a woman, and out of this ever medically would ever come up, let's say a woman within those first 40 days, she knows she's pregnant, let's say, and for whatever reason, and theoretically, it's Yom Kippur, and she would have to eat in order to maintain this pregnancy. So we assume this the halacha would say, it's Yom Kippur, she should eat to maintain the pregnancy. Or let's say she has to violate Shabbos for some reason. She quickly has to run to the hospital. We say violate Shabbos. Even within the first 40 days. Or Moshe says, you see that within the first 40 days, we do consider this to be a living being. And others say, no, that's not what the Gemara means. It means that there's a potential for life there. We have to, we'll violate one Shabbos so that the baby will keep, you know, multiple Shabbos and moving on. So back to your question, this too is a great matter of debate as to at what stage, you know, would the halakha be a little bit more potentially flexible? And which I'll just end off with this point. Interesting what Dr. Pruda said before about that most abortions, I believe, if I heard correctly, happen within the first 8 weeks. And the 8 weeks is from six weeks from conception. So 6 weeks come from conception. So that's about 42 days. So that's your 40-day period. And the 40 days is not specific, exactly 40 days. It's 41, 42, it's around that. So there seems that there would be a lot more room to maneuver. According again, Moshe Feinstein is I can't mention Moshe Feinstein because we take Moshe Feinstein very seriously. Most people love Moshe Feinstein because if they drink non-Chalav Yisrael milk, you're relying on Moshe Feinstein's leniency. So like, you know, if you say, oh, he's being too strict here, but he helps you out a lot of other areas. And we don't cherry pick in Jewish law. So his opinion is heavily weighted in considerations of things. So is it Tzitzel Yeller, so is others, and so you have these different approaches.
That's sort of one last nuanced question for my own kind of perspective as well. But you know, when we talk about something we did not mention in the earlier panels, but something called selective termination, where there is maybe a multi-fetal gestation, you know, twins, maybe, but triplets, you know, quadruplets, higher order multiples, and procedures done to help improve the odds of survivability and decrease other risk factors of pregnancy. Does the halacha have any other perspective of kind of, you know, selective termination to help the other one survive?
Yes, that's another difficult question. You know, in a situation where you have, let's say there's multiple, five, six, and you know that you can, I don't know if it's even possible, you can identify that babies A, B, and C are definitely not going to make it. So in theory, then those you could terminate and say, hopefully, okay, then we'll try now baby D and E, and hopefully that will work. Similarly, in a situation where if we continue this, none of them are going to make it. So then none of them are viable, and therefore that would seem to be another, you know, reason to certainly allow for some to be terminated. What gets a little more tricky is when I have, let's say there's two or three, and I want to maybe improve my odds. couple wants to, let's just do one. But there's a good chance that all three will be viable. So there, you're going to get into a lot more of an analysis and the consideration in such a situation.
I think we're sort of out of time, but I want to thank everyone. I want to thank the rabbi, I want to thank the computer, I want to thank Hill Nadler as well for coming up and sharing some important information, an important conversation and topic. And thank you all for joining us. Have a good night.
Yeah, let me just add one more point. I just wanted to you know, when it is a question of financial considerations or just a couple is not yet ready, so then I'm trying to present it from a halachic perspective. It's a lot more challenging to permit an abortion in that case. And and every case is unique, which needs to be discussed. Obviously, you know, the couple themselves, or the woman herself, and the physician, and the competent rabbi. Sometimes it's interesting. In Israel, for example, there's even an organization, I think it's called Efrat, that when it is a financial issue, where they it's a beautiful organization. They say over the last 10, 20 years, they've saved 80,000 babies that have been born, where they provide funding to help the parents, help the woman the first 2 years of whatever they need to make this this work and to function, whether adoption is an issue. And so you know, that's also something that's part of the conversation. And from a communal perspective, can a community help out a woman, help out a couple that's struggling, and be able to give them the emotional and sometimes the financial support, you know, to make it work? You know, that's also a part of the discussion. But again, what is most critical is in any of these cases is the sensitivity, and then understanding that this is a difficult emotional issue, it's a difficult medical issue, and it's also, from a Jewish perspective, a halachic issue. Every case is different, every case is distinct, and you may have, a couple may have heard that another couple didn't give a halachic sanction in one case, that it may be different for them, and maybe another case it was allowed in one case, but it's not going to be allowed. Every case has its nuances and its differences, and again, a competent posek would be able to work with the couple to try to help them out. And I'll just say the last thing, if the mother's life is at risk, and the doctor's saying that this needs to be terminated right away, you don't call your rabbi. You just get terminate the pregnancy and you save the mother's life. Okay, do we have, we can take a couple questions? Yeah, if anyone wants to chat in any questions or anyone in the audience, let's take a quick look on the chat. Otherwise, we'll call it an evening. Just take 1 minute. If there aren't any questions, that means we did a pretty good job. So, again, I want to thank everyone. Again, any more questions?
Let's see it on the chat. Can I
ask a question?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Dr. Pruder is asking a question.
So, and I didn't say anything about it. That's still a valid concept, or?
Yes, so the question is the fetus that in the side of the mother's womb, is the fetus considered to be a rode, a pursuer? And that's what that Mishnah I talked earlier in Olos, I went through it very quickly, discusses. The Rambam the Gemara assumes that once the baby is born, that the sort of, and at that point, the mother's life is at risk, the baby's halfway out, that they're both being a rode, they're pursuing one another, and we can't pick and choose, sort of let naturally allow life to take its course and to see what happens. Do our best to save both them, but if we can't, what happens. But inside the mother's womb, the Rambam assumed that the baby is sort of like a passive rodent, right? That the baby is sort of it's not a case where someone's pointing a gun at you. The baby's not intentionally trying to harm the mother. The baby wants the mother to live, but the fetus. But so it's sort of a passive rodent, and others assume. That Grashi probably assumes that we don't consider to be our baby a rodeif at all. It, again, in a way many understand Rashi, It's just that the mother's life is in danger, and we're allowed to save the mother's life. Again, the most it is, it's causing injury to the mother. We have to, the mother's life. A lot of let blood out if it's going to save someone. So, the term of a rodef inside is it's not the classic rodef. And for the Rambam, it's a little complicated. The Gemara seems to assume that it's really, on some level, none of these cases are, it's not an intentional rodef. It's not trying to, Gemara uses the expression, Shamaya karatulay. From heaven, this is happening. This is being pursued. Which implies inside the womb, it's not at all a rodef. If it's not a rodef, so then, why is the Rambam considered this to be murder? So some explain it's like a passive. So the bottom line is that, again, everyone is going to agree, though, when the pregnancy is caused, putting the mother's life at risk, that's where, we can terminate. And the question is, to what extent is that risk? Because, different rabbis are going to have different opinions. Yeah.
I have a question as well. So can you envision any situations where halacha, and assuming the Supreme Court overturns the rebate, that's going to happen, can you envision any scenarios where halacha and that might conflict, like the U.S. law? So, for example, or even if these laws are upheld in Texas or Mississippi, which give no exceptions to rape or incest, I'm curious about the halachic perspective, and that probably goes into kind of the emotional aspects that you were talking about. And let's say they do conflict, how do you think rabbis would then approach that situation? Let's say they counsel, there's a situation of rape or incest, okay, halachically it would be okay, terminate the pregnancy, obviously not allowed under the Texas law. What would then happen in that scenario?
Yeah, so if you didn't hear the question at home, the question is, if the court does overturn Roe v. Wade and uphold some of these other laws, how would that affect Jewish law? And what do we say about those things? And you talk about the issue of, we didn't really talk about rape and incest, but that's also part of the conversation from a halachic perspective, the emotional impact, on the woman and psychologically how damaging and painful that is. It comes to the larger question, should we advocate in this area? Whatever your opinion is, or from a halakhic perspective is, pro-choice, pro-life, pro-choice, should we be advocating our position? On the one hand, one could argue that from a religious perspective, the best legal perspective in American law is to respect religion, freedom of choice. And that because Jewish law is so nuanced in this area, and there seems to be, again, certainly if you take Rav Waldenberg's position, which many poskim do, or even under Rav Moshe Feinstein, but we discuss many situations that even we would have considered to be ritzicha, a murder. So, should we be more vocal in asking, the court to allow things to remain as is, and on the other hand, from another perspective, but at the same time, there's certain abortions that we're not comfortable with halachically, according to anyone. And therefore, should we take from a moral perspective, do we have an obligation to not only for ourselves, but for the larger American population or fellow citizens, to to take advocate the positions? And that's an interesting question in general. How, as citizens of living in this country, what role do we take, and should we take? Yeah, this is another, because this there's lots of issues that this applies to. But I think, and the reason why you're asking this question is that there are some serious concerns here, that if the laws become so restrictive, they may infringe upon our religious rights, our religious freedom. And I think that's a question that Dr. Naylor was asked earlier by Brittany about, that question, can there be other ways of, looking at this from a legal perspective to allow our religious sensitivities and perspectives to be able to advocate and define and navigate how we would, we would respond to any given potential termination. So I don't have an answer for that. It's something I think that really to grapple with and to think about.
Okay. I have a question from someone. There's a pasuk about two men fighting and hitting and injuring a pregnant woman. She then loses the baby, but no one is considered a murderer. And the question is, why is that person not considered a murderer?
Yes. So for the sake of time, I left out that source. That's another major source in this whole issue is a pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim in Sefer Shmos, where two men are fighting, they're getting carried away, and there's a woman who's pregnant who passes by, and they cause such a terrible blow, it causes the woman to miscarry. And so the law is that if the woman was not killed, I'm sorry, if the woman was not killed, but it causes the miscarriage, it causes the baby to be aborted, terminated, then you just pay a fine. And if the woman does die, so then there's no fine, then technically the person who killed the woman, if it was intentional, he would get killed. If it wasn't intentional, there would be other financial fine. We learn out from that exactly the point I started off with. We learn out from there that an abortion or terminating the development of the fetus, of the embryo, is not a capital case. It still may be murder, but it's not a capital offense for a Jew. In other words, that's how most halakhic decisors understand that pasuk. That tells us that it still may be murder, but unlike the non-Jew, where it's a capital offense, that's the pasuk with the Ben Noach, that doesn't apply in this case. There's one other very important Gemara I also didn't leave out, that's also part of the conversation, and that's the situation where a woman is pregnant, and she committed some capital offense. She worshipped idols. She violated Shabbos. She committed murder. And so she's 5 months pregnant, and nowadays we don't kill anyone. The Jewish courts don't do this, but in theory, back in the day, would we execute her? Well, by executing her, it would obviously, not only would she die, but that would cause a cessation of the pregnancy. And so the Gemara rules, the Mishnah rules in Erechin, that you kill her, even though the baby is going to be, it's going to be terminate the pregnancy. And the only exception, if she's in labor and she's about to deliver. So there, the argument is that you see, well, if we terminate the pregnancy, it seems like we're not so concerned. And again, there's a lot of the conversation, this Rambam and Waldenberg, everyone sort of tries to redefine that Gemara to fit into their position. Which is fascinating is that, again, you have a question of abortion, and there's, and I think Dr. Pruder mentioned earlier, that it's from the beginning of time that this has been something that human beings have dealt with. And in the Talmud, there's multiple discussions, at least four, five, six discussions where this comes up in different contexts.
One quick question. Many people have related abortion with woman's rights. The right of a woman to make a decision about their own health, their own body. How do they match the woman's rights in terms of the halacha?
Oh, the woman's rights. So, that's a general question. The question is about, how does halacha view the women's rights? So this is a question about, in general, about human rights and individual rights in Jewish law. And on the one hand, as I said when I began, we speak about sensitivity to people and their perspectives and their feelings and their emotions. But then there's also the objective law. I might feel that I have every desire and want and need to eat a cheeseburger or eat ham, that I want that, but the law does not allow for that. Now we can also talk to you and understand the emotional pain that you're experiencing, and what this means for you. And it's interesting, Waldenberg in some level does take the woman's feelings and emotions into consideration, because again, from his perspective that the prohibition of abortion would be causing a wound. Well, that's not murder, and you're allowed to cause a wound for one's health and for even cosmetic surgery where a person really feels that they need it is often allowed. So if the woman is taking everything into consideration and one's feelings and emotions, that would be a factor from his perspective. Okay, I think we're good. All right, again, thank you everyone for participating and for being here. This has been recorded, and we'll hopefully send it out soon. We'll post it so anyone can listen to it again. You can share it with others.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How many people joined?